I am Planta on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Sid Ryan joins me now. The labor leader and activist has just written a new book, A Grander Vision, My Life in the Labor Movement. It looks at his childhood in Ireland, his unionism, and how he has sought common cause with progressive elements in Canada and abroad. He writes of his many years at CUPE National and Ontario and the Ontario Federation of Labor. He also talks about the relationship between labor and the NDP and how the adoption of the LEAP Manifesto should be a priority. It is a candid book that also looks at his years at the fore of Ontario labor politics, the tense negotiations with the Bob Rae NDP government in Ontario, as well as the subsequent Mike Harris one. I also asked Mr. Ryan about what his future plans might hold. Would he run for political office again? Sid Ryan was the president of the Ontario Federation of Labor for 6 years. For 17 years before that, he was both president of CUPE Ontario and general vice president of CUPE National. The Twitter handle is at PSidRyan. This new book is published by Dundurn. He joined me from Whitby, Ontario, last week. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Sid Ryan. Mr. Ryan, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Our day is afternoon here.
Afternoon in Whitby, yeah. The upbringing in Ireland, that's how you open the book, and it's a tough childhood that you have, but it certainly shaped you early on, those values that you have come to be known for. I mean, those really came from that upbringing, didn't it?
Yes, it did. But I will say this much, though. You know, as tough as it is when you read, you know, the lack of money, I guess, that was in our family as a child growing up, I have to say I had a wonderful childhood. Mm. It was full of, you know, amazing memories, and some of them come across in the book. In addition to some of the hardships. But, I mean, looking back on my childhood, and even all of my brothers and sisters all shared the same viewpoint, we had an amazing childhood that was, you know, full of love and laughter and games and, you know, things that we did. But there were some, certainly there were things in there that shaped my life, you know, in terms of going out to work at a very early age, you know, part-time jobs to try and make things, make ends meet at home, situations that I encountered as a child, even as a young apprentice in the workplace as a 16-year-old. You know, I came across a lot of abuse that takes place in workplaces, and I guess even today, mm-hmm. Some workers probably encounter some of the abuses that I encountered as a 16-year-old.
And it was a big family. Was politics, was that something important to your family? Was that something you were aware of, say, at an early age?
I was aware of politics. I would say I was about 12, and I became aware of it because my father was political. Mm. He had spent some time in England during a period when there was not much work in Ireland, so he had to go across to earn a living in England and send the money back home. So that in itself was political in the sense that, you know, there was no work in the country, but he came back with a sense of social justice. He was obviously interested in the Labour Party, and I do recall sitting listening to the results coming in from the UK, where Harold Wilson, at the time the leader of the Labour Party, mm-hmm. was ahead in the polls, and he was my father was quite thrilled with that. So I got a real sense at that point, and I took an interest then in politics. Because my father was, you know, he was an avid reader certainly of the newspapers, the broadsheets that he would read from cover to cover, you know, and then start to talk to me about different columns that I should be taking a look at and reading. So, yeah, at a relatively early age, I became interested in politics.
When was it that you had a sense of what you wanted to be? I mean, I guess that's a question that all kids have, is what they want to be when they grow up. Was there something in mind that you wanted to do, sir?
My ambition, I guess, as a teenager was, as a 14, 15, 16-year-old, I wanted to go to university, that just wasn't on. You know, university at the time wasn't free in Ireland, and in any event, when we reached an age where we could go out and work, it was expected that we'd contribute to the family coffers. Mm. So I never got a chance to go to university. Instead, I ended up going into the trades, and I never really was very happy while I was in the trades. But it's only when I came to Canada as a 22-year-old that I got a real sense in my first job. I helped to organize a union for the United Steelworkers, and I thought to myself, okay, I found my calling. I loved it. And from that moment on, I never really looked back in terms of my involvement in the labor movement. I continually moved on through getting elected as a shop steward and chief steward and union president and so on, and basically held most of the positions in the union. But I would say it was the sense, the rush that I got from helping to organize a union after, you know, right, only a couple of weeks after arriving in Canada, mm-hmm. that gave me the real sense of what I wanted to do.
As I was reading your book, Grander Vision, I kind of wondered, because you write of some very heady days there in Ontario when you were at CUPE and the OLC, and, of course, you talk about the time that you came to Canada in the mid-70s. Is labor still a force to be reckoned with today? I mean, are unions still relevant, do you think?
They're very much relevant, but I would say a lot depends upon the individual union leaders. If a union has a progressive union leader, typically speaking, the union then gets involved in whether it be international politics or whether it be social unionism, or helps organize the community and takes on government when they basically come after workers. A lot of unions, unfortunately, are into what I call business trade unionism, which means they look after the bread and butter issues, collective bargaining and grievances by and large, and then leave the politics up to the political parties. And I just don't believe in that sense of unionism. I think the more unions get into the business trade unionism, the more they lose their members, because the members don't really see them being relevant to them in their communities and in their activities outside of the workplace. So, you know, you can see in Canada, we were around 40-odd percent union density at one time, meaning all, like 40% of all workers belong to the union. We're down now to about 29%, maybe it ticked up, you know, marginally just a little while back. United States, it's down to about 11%. If you take out the public sector, only about 7% of the private sector is organized. So the more density you lose, the less clout you've got. So I'm seeing that the labor movement in Canada, I don't think, is fighting hard enough. For example, they just gave a free pass to Trudeau to go and sign two trade agreements that we're absolutely and fundamentally opposed to. The CETA agreement with Europe, yep. And the TPP. We're absolutely opposed to free trade agreements, but we gave them a free pass, not a word.
Yeah. You also write in the book that you're disheartened by the labor movement's lack of response to the threat of workers' rights following the election of Doug Ford. What might the current leadership say in the trade unions in Ontario? What might they do better?
Well, you had a meeting in Toronto where you brought together about 850 local union leaders and provincial union leaders, and I guess there were some national union leaders there. And I thought, this is only just in March, or the 25th of March, I was expecting that they were going to come out and say they're going to form a common front with community partners across the province. I was expecting that they would say they were going to do what we did in the 1990s with Mike Harris, where we had days of actions, mm-hmm. and we managed to close down 12 or 13 cities across the province, brought 250,000 people onto the streets of Toronto to send a signal to Harris, you have to back off, and he did in many respects. The result coming out of the March 25th meeting here in Toronto recently was basically that we will, as a union movement, lobby the Tory backbenchers in their local communities. And I thought, like, my God, that's just, you know, hot air. That's not a campaign. Mm. So I'm sorely disappointed that the activity hasn't taken place. But I do know that the rank and file wanted to happen. For example, there's just two young women just put up a notice on Facebook there last week saying that they were going to call for a general strike on May the 1st. Now, we know that's not going to happen, but they got 12,500 likes, thousands of people saying they're going to show up at Queen's Park at noon hour on May the 1st. So you can see there's an appetite for people wanting to take action, but they need the union leaders to step forward. And the reason I say the union leaders to step forward, they've got the resources. I mean, because the community organizations have relatively little or no resources. So So they need big organizations, the big unions, to put seed money out to help them organize within their own communities. And I'm not seeing that kind of leadership today, and that's disappointing.
And that's something that can be said about you. I mean, you write in the book about what you saw in Seattle at the WTO protests there. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of photos in the book of you at marches and at protests and the sort. That's a fundamental, I guess, aspect of the labor movement that we don't see anymore amongst the current leadership across the country. And so I'm also wondering if maybe society itself has changed, the culture has changed, that where maybe that's not an important aspect anymore. But as you write in the book, in A Grander Vision, especially at the end of the book, that's got to be an important part of it, right?
Yeah. It's got to be, you know, it's got to be coupled in with, you know, activities on our picket lines. We need to be able to demonstrate that we've got some clout in the labor movement. And it isn't all about demonstrations, of course, because demonstrations on their own, you know, hardly ever change anything. But if you couple it with the activity of working with, you know, for example, right now in Ontario, a major issue in the province is how the government is treating the question of autism, you know, the young children and the funding of it in the school system. We should be aligning ourselves in the labor movement with the parents who've got autistic children. The Workers' Action Center, for example, they actually moved the $15 an hour campaign in this province. There was very little funding actually came in from trade unions, only 5% of their total budget in 2016 when they had their major breakthrough. But they demonstrated that they could conduct street theater demonstrations and also effective lobbying and intelligent lobbying of the politicians and essentially put the question of $15 an hour on the map for the average worker and for the average parent who knew that sending their kids to university didn't necessarily mean that they're going to graduate with a good job. So most of these kids who are graduating from university were coming back home after 4 years and living in the basement of their parents' homes, you know, so they could see, wait a second, it makes a lot of sense that we start to move the minimum wage up to $15 an hour, and that in turn moves everybody else up, and we start to create some decent jobs. But, you know, it's the connection between the community and the labor movement is the missing link. And if the labor movement could only see that getting out onto the streets and being visible, it's not an end in itself, but it certainly is part of the package that moves public opinion and moves government to alter course.
Well, what struck me too as I was reading your book, A Grander Vision, Sid, was you, and it's the title of one of the chapters, is that you seem to be at home in the world, that you talk about these many advocacies that you've had outside of Canada, the friendships and the connections that you've made with people of common cause. There's a lesson there, isn't there, in terms of how to think about one's place in the world?
Well, this is it. You've definitely got to look outside of our own borders. And it's not that the Canadians are coming into South American countries or anywhere in the world and basically saying, we're going to show you how to do it. Mm-hmm. Quite the opposite, as a matter of fact. We learned a lot from the unions in Latin America about how to go about fighting privatization. I mean, the El Salvadorans, they actually went out to the streets in the hundreds of thousands to stop their government from privatizing the healthcare system. So when I saw that, we said, hey, let's invite them up into Canada and take some other countries that are, you know, neighboring countries with them, and we'll sit down and form an alliance between the Canadian frontline workers and workers in Latin America. And that in itself then became the catalyst for when they tried to put in the free trade of the Americas, the FTAA. Mm. We had ready-made partners in South America that we could call upon to start agitating in their own countries to fight against the free trade of the agreements of the Americas. So, you know, so those connections that we made came back to us in spades later on because it actually helped defeat the FTAA.
Right. The chapter in terms of the Bob Rae years, the NDP government in Ontario from 90 to 95 is awfully dramatic. Before we talk about what he might have done better, I noticed at least three times in the book you talk about Rae walking into a room or a meeting with his left hand in his pocket, I was wondering what you think that says about a person.
Well, I tried to give the reader a sense of, you know, what kind of a personality Bob Ray actually was behind the scenes. And he's a fairly shy individual, and he's not very comfortable in a one-on-one situation around people. When he sits down and he starts getting into policy, then he's in his element. But when he's working the room, he's very awkward, and that's, you know, I guess it was a reflexive thing he would do. He'd stick his left hand into his suit pocket, and it demonstrated to me that he wasn't very open and warm and welcoming. He was like wooden and stiff and not comfortable, except when he sat down, then he was into his element and he was talking about policy. So that sort of clouded, I think, a little bit the negotiations and the discussions long before we ever even get into the social contract. I just felt, you know, there wasn't that bond, that connection between us. It seemed to be that he was, I won't say necessarily of a different class, but he was certainly different than the workers that I had around me in the room when we would go to meet with him.
So he was elected in 1990. How soon after that did the honeymoon sour, if you will, between the labor movement and the NDP government there?
Well, there was quite a period of really progressive legislation that the government, that the Ray government brought in around pay equity and rent controls and helping workers that were losing their jobs, like, you know, industry that was failing, and they were putting money into it, people on welfare. He was trying to get people off of welfare by giving incentives to employers to hire them in the first year to get them off the welfare rolls. So there was a lot of good, positive stuff happening in the early days. But then he started making moves towards, you know, Sunday shopping, which really ticked off a whole bunch of workers in the retail sector. And it wasn't like a major breakdown, but it was, you know, the beginnings of, like, wow, he's doing this and he's not really talking to the labor movement, but he's, you know, creating favor with the business communities. But the one that really, I think, began to rupture the relationship was a lot of people, myself included, knocked on doors to get the NDP elected. And the number one issue that we were out there hearing time and time and time again from Liberals in particular was, if you bring in public auto insurance, we're going to give air vote. If we can trust Bob Ray to bring in public auto insurance, he's got air vote. And I think that was the one issue that really galvanized the voting public behind the NDP. And when he broke that promise after getting, you know, pilloried by the insurance industry, who put, you know, 10,000 people onto Queen's Park in a demonstration saying you're going to lay off about 20,000-30,000 folks out of the auto insurance business. When that happened and he backed away from it, I think he lost an awful lot of credibility with people in the labor movement, but the voting public in general, who were not necessarily voting NDP because they were NDPers all their lives, but because there was a promise made, and when he broke that promise, I think he broke faith with the voting public, and that's where he began to lose public opinion.
So you write in the book that you had looked to, those of you in the labor movement had looked to an NDP government as being friendly to your organizations, but it didn't turn out that way in the Ray case. So what is the relationship that labor should have with the NDP? And you write about that too extensively near the end of the book, about the relationship, say, the CLC should have with the NDP.
Well, in the case of Ray, the big mistake was, I mean, he had he was trying to extract out of the union movement a major amount of concessions, which would involve opening our collective agreements. And rather than sitting down with the labor movement in a serious way and say, look, we need to talk about how we can go about doing this, and then listen to some suggestions that would be coming back and forth across the table. Mm-hmm. Instead, he sort of announced publicly he was going to call the business community, he was going to call the labor movement, and he was going to put the bosses of the public sector all in the same room. And I thought, my God, this is like... you know, the Tories getting elected and saying to the bankers and to the businesses on Bay Street, we're going to get you into a room with the union movement and you're going to give us up all sorts of concessions with respect to tax increases. Mm. It was a crazy way of going about the business. So when he called the public meeting, we were sort of caught out in the public view trying to negotiate with what was meant to be a friendly government, but they were actually currying favor with the business community at the same time as with the bosses in the public sector. So, you know, it was inevitable that there'd be a confrontation. Mm. But leaving that aside, we got out of the social contract. But at the end of the day, I mean, I never did walk away from the NDP as a consequence of that. I still am a staunch NDP supporter, and I firmly believe that the NDP or that the Labour movement should be strong partners with the NDP. But unfortunately, the Labour movement have got a bunch of individual union leaders who are more closely aligned with the Liberals today than what they are with the NDP. And that's what I'm calling for, is this major debate inside of the House of Labour, where we put this issue of strategic voting to bed once and for all. And this support for Liberals, you know, where, you know, a big chunk of the Labour movement are supporting the Liberals. A big chunk of them are agnostic and are just sitting on the fence. And there's a smaller number of them who are avid NDP supporters. We need to fix that relationship because it's not working for us.
Yeah, and so the leadership of the CLC, that comes up next year, 2020.
The guy that's there right now, Hassan Youssef, he's reaching mandatory retirement age. Mm. Sure, I know that the law of the land says that you cannot force people to retire at 65, but there's a history in the labor movement that people do step aside when they hit the age of 65. So the expectation is that he will. And then in there, I think, lies an opportunity to have a real debate about the future of the labor movement and the relationship with the NDP. So I'm hoping that when new candidates are running to replace the existing president as he retires in 2020, that there will be a real debate on the floor, that candidates will come forth with their ideas and their suggestions about how do we fix the relationship with the NDP such that we don't get into these fights every time there's a federal election where we don't know what kind of a milquetoast campaign that the CLC is going to run, which in my mind, it's basically that campaigns are like dog whistles to vote for the Liberals, and then if you can find an NDP candidate that you think might win, you can support them as well. Mm. But the general thrust appears to be, let's go out and elect the Liberals, and that's not where the Labour movement was in the 1960s when we decided to put together a coalition between the CCF and the Labour movement and call it the NDP.
Yeah, and so what role will you be playing at that convention next year?
Well, I'll be there as a delegate. You know, so I'll play that role. Normally, I get up to the microphones and I can give a half-decent speech, so I'll be saying what needs to be said and hopefully giving some directions to the different unions. I mean, there's a lot of unions, like my own union, CUPE, that are staunch supporters. Mark Hancock, who's out of British Columbia, is a very staunch NDP supporter. And so is Fred Hahn. And in fact, most of the CUPE leadership right across the country, if not all, are very strong NDP supporters. We know that the steel workers are very strong supporters, UFCW. So we have some good, solid supporters in the hall. And keeping in mind, Unifor will probably not be on the convention because they've left the CLC. So if they're not in the hall, the chances of the labor movement having a better relationship with the NDP has increased exponentially.
Yeah. Now, you've run federally and provincially a couple of times each. Has that been something that you thought of doing again, even?
Well, funny that you say that. I was at the Day of Mourning yesterday in Oshawa, and I've been approached many, many, many times throughout the day to see if I would consider putting my hat into the ring. I said I would give it some serious consideration. I mean, I've been involved in it with, preparing for the release of my book, and my daughter got married in Cuba just recently, so I was preoccupied with that. So now I'm saying, okay, I'll give it some serious thought. The conservative that's in there right now, Oshawa only ever goes NDP or conservative. Like, it rarely goes Liberal. So we've had a lot of job loss in Oshawa through the auto plant and all of the subsidiaries. The Tory hasn't done the job. I talked about protecting the auto sector and coming up an auto strategy. When he got elected 15 years ago, there were 10,000 workers in the plant. Today, there's 2,500, and in a few months' time, there'll be nobody. So I do think there's an opportunity here this time around to drive a good, strong agenda and demonstrate to the voters in Oshawa that voting Tory is not helping the city of Oshawa.
There's a marvelous conversation that you have after, I guess, you were elected president of CUPE. You called your mom up, and you were telling her the news, obviously, and you both were in tears because you were thinking of your dad and what he would have thought of your career up to that point. But and then I'm wondering, as I'm reading the book, what he would have thought of this career that you've had and now that you've written about. I mean, he certainly would have been proud, wouldn't he?
Oh, there's no question about it. When I got elected, yeah, I do recall I was, you know, I went up to the room and phoned my mother in Ireland. And of course, my dad had died a number of years earlier. And we reminisced about, because he was a strong union man as well. Like, he led a strike in the auto plant that he worked in and used their home, the little home that we had, as a strike headquarters. So there's no question he was very much involved and would have loved to have seen me in as the president of CUPE and later on the president of the OFL. And then, of course, to put it all into a book would have been the icing on the cake for him. So, yes, that was bittersweet for me in some respects. But even writing the first part of this book, I actually went to Ireland and spent a month in the west of Ireland. Mm-hmm. And I cried a lot. And, you know, it got a lot out of my system in some respects, thinking about my brothers and my sisters and my parents, the different stories that I came up with that I vividly recalled and tried to capture as best as I could in the book. So, yeah, I mean, the whole experience has been, you know, really one, for me at least anyways, that was gratifying and sad at the same time, because life is like that, of course. You know, we don't always have our parents around and be able to share. One thing, though, you just triggered me right now that I'm thinking about. Mm-hmm. One of the things I did say in the book as well, and it's so true, I never realized as a 22-year-old and I was leaving my home in Dublin to come to Canada that I'd probably only ever get to see my parents a handful of times after that. And that's just the tough part for immigrants. Mm-hmm. You come and you start a new life in no matter what country it may be, but you leave behind an awful lot. We left behind, you know, my parents and my wife's parents, but also too, my children never really got to know their grandparents and drop around on a Sunday afternoon for dinner and all that kind of stuff. There's you know, an awful lot that you miss out on as an immigrant, and that's why I fight so hard for immigrant rights, refugee rights, asylum seekers' rights. It really burns my ass when I hear people down on immigrants.
Yeah, you talk about that in the book. You noticed when you came to Canada that the immigrants like yourself were treated different than the ones that, say, came from the Caribbean.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, I heard the phrase that was coined, the white privilege. I didn't, of course, understand it at the time. But, yeah, I went for a job in a major hotel downtown Toronto, and I was not even asked about I was an apprentice plumber. And the only thing this gentleman talked about that was interviewing me was these black guys from the islands. And, you know, I always make sure I keep their results and their marks in the drawer down here. And he opened the drawer and he showed me all the folders that he had. He said, because these guys go to the Human Rights Commission all the time. But he never really asked me any questions about my qualifications and so on, but essentially offered me the job nonetheless, because I'm from the old country, is what he told me. And I didn't understand what he meant by the old country. I wasn't certain what he meant. But really and truly what it is, it's just code language essentially for white Europeans. And so I got a job, at least I was offered a job, on the strength of the color of my skin rather than on the skill sets that I was bringing to the job, because he didn't have a clue what kind of skill I had. Yeah. So, and then later on when I got involved in the labor movement, I heard this story over and over and over to the point where you could see there's a huge amount of racism that is just beneath the surface here. And you don't necessarily see it as you walk down Yonge Street, but you certainly see it when you get into the workplaces.
Yeah. The you mentioned going back to Ireland and thinking back to your childhood in the sword, and you write also at the end of the book about it's throughout the book, I should say, your love for Canada. But when you're back home in Ireland, and I slip there and use the word home, does it still feel like home?
It does, no question about it. My accent even changes. Because, you know, you may think, no, I'm speaking fast, I don't know. But when I get back to Dublin, it speeds up about an extra 30 or 40%. So you get caught up in the lifestyle, but I slip back into it so easily. It's almost as if I've never been away. And when I meet people, some of them will still say, hey, I haven't seen you around in a long time. How come you're never down the pub these days or something like that, right? And I say, yeah, I've been gone 40 years. That's why you haven't seen me. Yeah. But, it still is home in many ways. I mean, obviously Canada is home. My children, my grandchildren made my life. I've had a wonderful life in Canada. And I brought my mum out here, you know, a dozen times or more.
Yeah.
And my father maybe once or twice. But Ireland is still in the blood, so it's a thrill when you go back and you just sort of slip back into the lifestyle over there, which is completely different than the lifestyle over here.
Yeah, and that the end of the book, I mean, that's why it's called A Grander Vision, is because you talk about what needs to happen not only in this country but in the wider world, and so. It continues, doesn't it? The struggle continues and the fight continues for you, doesn't it?
Well, I have no question about it. I mean, I tried to lay out where I really see where the Labour movement has got to start to champion, for example, the Leap Manifesto, which is essentially the Green New Deal in my mind. And it lays out all the principles there, not just only dealing with climate, but about the types of jobs, the green jobs, which is makes a lot of sense to me, which would be grow the healthcare sector, grow the education sector, grow social services, municipal services, start taking a look at the new technologies when it comes to solar energy and wind power. I got family in Denmark, and when I go to Denmark, it's a country that's, you know, a population that's about one-fifth the size of Canada,
mm-hmm.
and I'm blown away when I see these huge monster trucks on the highways with these big blades from the wind turbines. They've got a thriving industry building wind turbines and exporting them all over the world. These are all really, really good paying jobs, unionized jobs, you know, for technicians and welders and, millwrights and engineers. And it's just incredible the way the work that we could be producing here in this country. And instead, you know, we're focused in on the extractive industries and looking at the oil sands to try and fuel the economy when it's a dying industry. I just so ticked off that some union leaders won't stand up and be honest with their members and say, we've got to start to transition as quickly as possible away from the carbon-based economy into the new energy economies. And as far as fighting with government to put in place programs that you've got in Denmark, where if you lose your job, you can get, if you're willing to go back to school to be retrained for a new job, new profession, you get 90% of your salary.
Mm.
And the fund that pays for that is basically a tax that's put on employers. We could be fighting for that here in Canada, but we're not. We're just sitting back supporting the Liberals and then asking them for subsidies for the oil and gas industries or subsidies for the auto industry, which all that's doing is sucking money away from the public sector jobs that we need, healthcare, education.
Sid, I could talk to you all afternoon. I've enjoyed reading your book, and I've enjoyed our conversation today. Good luck with this book. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the interview as well. Thank you.
The book is called A Grander Vision, My Life in the Labor Movement. It's published by Dundurn. Sid Ryan joined me on the line from Whitby, Ontario. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plata.